You're listening to the Product Podcast by Product School.
Definitely don't just assume that the first way you came up to do something is the right way to do it. And a lot of people tend to get like married to their solution or their idea instead of to the problem and what it is they're trying to solve. So really like start with the problem you're trying to solve and fully understand the trade-offs and different ways of going about solving it. And also if you make any assumptions about something being possible, it's good to try and test it and break those assumptions early through informal discussions before you actually do a bunch of spec work or start working on something in a serious way. And finally, this is also the stage in product development where you really want to be making the case for the impact of this feature. You want to ask yourself, like, am I solving a niche problem or do I have data that shows that this problem actually affects my target market in a significant way? So that's testing your assumptions. The third one, and I alluded to this a little bit earlier, is like, you know, the first thing you bring in on day one also shouldn't be like a large 30-page document. Sort of like being lazy can be kind of a good thing in the sense like the worst thing you can do is like some really smart people will like hear an idea or start working on something, go off into hiding, and then produce this document that was just written from ideas in their head. And you really don't want to do this until you've like fully validated your assumptions, until you've had more informal conversations and buy-in from your team and other key stakeholders, and you sort of have general alignment before you go through and figure out all the details of how this is going to work. So once you've done your homework and you have a pretty good case for the thing you're trying to build, the next thing you can do is to try to actually prototype this. And I really, really do believe in the power of the demo. Kind of your demo is going to get more attentions and more eyeballs, and it's just easier to share and more attention grabbing than a document. And it's nice to have something that people can easily share and pass around and get excited about. And obviously a lot of us as product managers, we're not technical, but you can. This is where you can get engineers or prototypers or other folks on the team to help you out. And obviously a concern there is, okay, like how do you convince this person to do the work? Obviously everyone is busy, everyone has a lot of stuff on their plate, but typically if you get someone excited enough about your idea, you can get them to spare enough of their time to help you come up with a prototype. An analogy I really like for this is like the dancing guy video. I don't know how many of you guys have seen this. It's pretty funny, but basically there's like a guy who's just dancing on his own, and everyone is just like staring at him and like, what is this guy doing? But as soon as another person joins him, it leads to everyone getting up and dancing, and it turns into a giant dance party. So it's sort of like, you know, getting one other person excited and bought in is really all it takes. And often just that one person bought in can validate your idea and can help you build momentum to get more supporters and make your idea happen. And then finally, even if you can't do a demo or a prototype, it's really good to visually represent your feature in some way that gets people talking about it. And you don't have to be a designer or have a lot of design knowledge to make this happen either. You may have seen like these mocks, like balsamic mocks. It's like a really popular tool for creating these super low fidelity mocks. And they look really crappy, and that's sort of intentional. Like they use Comic Sans and like sort of look hand-drawn. And the reason for that is with this sort of mock, it's obvious that this isn't the final visual design. Like people aren't going to argue about the positions of like pixels or colors on the screen because they know this is meant to be purely illustrative and sort of low fidelity. So at this phase, you know, you're not trying to get design feedback, but rather you're trying to get feedback on the high-level idea and the thing you're actually trying to do. And these sorts of like PM mocks are a great way of doing that. So once you've done your homework and you have your idea like somewhat developed, now comes the hard part of actually convincing people to do the work. Sometimes you're lucky and your teams are able to just take this on and add this to their priority queue. But more likely than not, that's not the case. Teams have already committed to an established set of priorities, and it's your job to convince people that your idea is higher priority than what they've already committed to. So I'll talk about two methods of kind of going about this. One is a sort of a bottoms-up consensus approach, where you work directly with the team and try to convince them. The other is more top-down, where you work with leadership and try to get their buy-in and you have more of a top-level initiative to make your feature happen. So obviously, in order to make like an ideal situation, you can directly convince the people who need to do the work that they should work on your idea. And that's the easiest way to go. And so I would say that the single most important thing here is just that people are genuinely excited about your idea. Obviously, if people don't care about your idea, they'll always come up with reasons why they don't want to work on it. But a lot of times, those are just made up reasons, and the real reason is people aren't that excited about it. So it's not sufficient, but it's definitely a necessary condition if you want to convince a team to do something. And another thing that's important is also, the team needs to be convinced that your idea is actually good. So this can be that your idea is good for the user, that it's good for the business, and also that what you're proposing can be reasonably implemented, and you're not proposing something that's completely undoable or is impossible or has been like tried before and failed. And then there's sort of a third thing. It's not just sufficient that people are excited and that your idea is good, but also this one is the harder one, where people really need to be convinced that implementing your idea is going to be the best thing for them personally. And this one's especially challenging because like everyone's motivated by different things. So for some people, it's just the personal satisfaction of like fixing something that was bugging them. With other people, it's like recognition in the eyes of leadership. And other people are excited by like driving business goals. It's like everyone is excited by something different. So it's kind of important for you to figure out what it is that motivates people, that drives people, and figure out how to refine your pitch in a way that gets everyone rallying around that idea. So this is sort of the mechanisms you can go about for driving bottoms-up consensus, and this is the ideal way of getting things done if you can. But obviously, this isn't always an option. Sometimes you need to drive things in an org that isn't yours, that has no incentive to help you out. In other cases, what you're trying to do requires a pretty big strategic shift that needs alignment all the way from leadership down. So this is where you need more top-down consensus, or you need to escalate. A lot of people have like sort of a negative connotation with escalation, but it's not necessarily a bad thing, and it's definitely not something that anyone should take personally. The last thing you want to be stuck in is kind of a limbo state, and so escalations are a great tool to get decisions quickly made, and most organizations are set up in a way to at least be somewhat supportive of that, and they at the end of the day, leadership wants to unblock you, they want you to work, and if you are not working because you haven't made a decision, they won't be happy about that. So, of course, this isn't a perfect route or anything. There's a lot of problems with a more top-down approach. Obviously, one big one is as a product manager, there's a limited amount of executive capital you have and time with execs. So you don't want to like be escalating every day. You kind of want to pick your battles and use this when it matters the most. Secondly, there's always an outcome that escalations won't end up the way you want to. If you don't have a strong enough case, you don't have enough support from other senior stakeholders, you can lose the escalation, and that's not fun either. And then third, even if you win the escalation and things go well, you can end up in a situation in which like the leadership is bought in, but the team that's actually doing the work is like kind of not very motivated to do it and sort of disgruntled because they just got overridden. And you can end up with low quality work as a result of that, just because people aren't intrinsically motivated to do something, and no one enjoys being sort of told what to do. So definitely like bottoms up is the preferred approach of getting buy-in if you want to go about something, but sometimes you do need to escalate to get things done. Some things that I found to help escalations go well is, obviously, I found before you just talk directly to leadership, kind of maybe taking a step back, like as humans, like we all take shortcuts to making decisions, whether that's us or even our leaders and people we respect. Everyone takes shortcuts to decision making, especially at a leadership level. There's like so many decisions you're having to make every day and things that are in front of you, one of the most important factors in a decision is sort of like trust. A lot of these decisions are very relationship-based in the sense that if you have a relationship with certain people who you trust, leadership will often run ideas by people underneath them who are domain-level expertises in that space and who they trust. So generally, companies are relationship-driven, and you'll want to refine your pitch, and it helps to get a lot of other senior endorsers to support your idea before you go straight to like the VP or the CEO or whoever it is you're taking this to. So definitely it helps to start with someone kind of under the person you're trying to pitch, who you know is kind of close to them. You can use this person to sort of refine your pitch, You can also use this person as support, since hopefully they agree with what you're doing and will back you up. And also, you want someone who understands the leader and can help you predict their concerns and prepare for them in the right way. So once you have this senior endorser, then you can take your idea to leadership. I think the most important thing here is just like knowing your audience and knowing who you're talking to. Every leader I've worked with is like motivated by something different. In some cases, like leaders are very competition driven and they're always thinking about, oh, what is my competitor doing? And in that case, you kind of want to refine your pitch to be very competition based. Or in other cases, like leadership doesn't care about revenue, but they really just care about user satisfaction, and that's been a problem. So it sort of helps to like understand what keeps them up at night and figure out how what you are working on solves that problem, and kind of use that to refine and define your pitch and really appeal to that. And then finally, the last thing I'll say here is like, and I've really learned this over the years, is like less is definitely more, and you know, quality is so much more important than quantity. All it takes is like one weak argument to take a few strong arguments and make them sound really bad. So if you think of one of your arguments or your reasons for doing something is not as strong as your other arguments, it is better to eliminate it entirely than to try to just give a barrage of arguments, because often people judge you by the worst argument you make. So it definitely helps to be very concise, kind of less is more, narrow down your pitch to the most compelling arguments that you have. And third, like, you know, obviously once you've taken this idea to leadership, you don't want to just forget about it afterwards. It's your responsibility to kind of be proactive and follow up on all these items. Some things I found that helps is like sending periodic updates to execs, even if it's just like an email every month or something that tells them how things are going, how your project has panned out after they've made this decision. And it also helps just to make sure that you have the right level of visibility. One thing I found especially is like, you know, people want to, if they make a decision, they want to see how things are going. And also generally execs don't like surprises. So this is a good way to raise risks early and make them aware of any things that they should know instead of them hearing about it through like the news or through some other outlet that isn't through you. So that's kind of everything I had around building consensus. But of course, like sometimes you can't build consensus, and for sometimes in certain cases, it may make sense to just try and get your hands dirty and do something yourself. And there's a few techniques that I've done for this in the past. This was a feature that I really wanted to make happen when we were working on, this was a few years ago when we were building Android N, Android Nougat. I really wanted to, we wanted to have a feature where you could store emergency medical information on your phone and you could have emergency contacts. Basically, like in case of an emergency, a first responder could pull up your phone and see this information about you, and it could help save your life. And it made a lot of sense for us to do it. And like everyone was like, yes, this is a great idea, we should do it. But the problem is also at the time, we were in sort of a crisis state trying to get a bunch of features in for the release. We hadn't made much progress on this feature and we had to make a lot of hard decisions about cuts. So kind of one thing I did, at least, like, you know, I come from a software engineering background, so I brushed up on my Android development and I worked on building the feature myself. And thankfully, I found engineers who were like willing to do code reviews for me, and eventually they took over and maintained the code, probably because that was easier than trying to do code reviews for me. But like in this case, it was a relatively small feature, and for the work that I had to have done to convince a bunch of people, I knew I could just start building it myself, and that was a good way for me to just get enough momentum and support to eventually hand this off to a team of people who maintain it full time. Another thing that I really, really do personally believe in is like sort of doing something wrong is better than not doing it at all. And this sounds kind of counterintuitive and doesn't make sense at first. But kind of like basically the way I see this is like wrong decisions are better than no decisions. Like the worst thing you can have is decision paralysis, where you're afraid of doing anything because you don't know what the right answer is. And I found it's much more effective to admit that you might be wrong and not everything you do is going to be perfect. Make a decision and at least like quickly course correct if you find that you're going down the wrong path. Obviously, you don't want to make a wrong decision, know that you're wrong and stick to it. But if you make a wrong decision and you see data that, and it's based on assumptions, and you see data that proves those assumptions wrong, That's a good time to reevaluate your decision and figure out if you want to course correct. And you've probably heard the term straw man before, which is like an intentionally weak argument that's set up to be easy to defeat. Similarly, like if you take initiative and put together a proposal or start building something, it's really nice to get people to a point where you're arguing about implementation details or specific UX or the right ways to do things, and less about the feature itself, in which case you've sort of already won. Because people aren't arguing about, is this a good idea? They're arguing about, like, should this code go here? Is this built the right way? Does this look the right way? So as soon as you steer the direction and discussion in that direction, you've already made a huge step forward. And finally, like, you know, if you have a great idea and can't get buy-in, it might make sense for you to just take your idea and do it yourself. Oftentimes, a lot of good companies pass on really great ideas. And that isn't always because, like, the company is, you know, incompetent or makes bad decisions, but a lot of times, like, the idea you want to do is just outside of the core focus of the business. And in many cases, for example, at Google, I've seen projects that, revenue-producing projects that get passed on just because they don't have the potential to drive billions in revenue, but only, like, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. And for, like, most of us in the room, that's, like, a life-changing amount of money and enough of an opportunity for us to, like, pursue outside of the corporate setting. So definitely, the example I have on here too, you guys are probably familiar, like Steve Wozniak designed the Apple One when he was at HP, and they tried to offer it to them like 5 times and they kept saying no. And so he finally gave up and like started Apple with Steve Jobs. So sometimes there are like truly great ideas that don't make sense in your organizational context, but they can be great opportunities on their own that make sense for you to go off and pursue. So that's kind of everything I had around taking an idea to market in your company. It's my first time giving this talk, and it's not a subject I've talked about before, so I'm definitely curious if people found this helpful or not. But I was thinking we'd use the rest of the time to just ask questions and have an open discussion about things. So, thank you.
So I heard another great idea, which is if you need the engineers to do something, or the people who need buy-in, they're not seeing what you see. And so therefore you show them what the customer is seeing, which is what you're seeing, and that will persuade them. It seems like it might work, but I haven't tried it.
Yeah, I think that definitely makes a lot of sense. I think you want your engineers to like feel the pain of the user or the customer. So if you can figure out a way to kind of like I find often when we do UX research and user studies, I'll have engineers sit in on that, and it's kind of eye opening to be like, wow, this thing that we thought was super intuitive, everyone is struggling through it and making, you know, getting confused on the way. So definitely, it's like I feel like a lot of times when you just look at data all day and graphs, there isn't that empathy of like feeling the pain of what the user or the customer actually feels. So yeah, 100%, I think that's a really great way to get people convinced or bought in about something. Anyone else?
So you mentioned that you worked in some smaller startups in the past before joining Google. So were you in the product development team in the past, or how did you transition into a PM role?
And what kind of what kind of advantages that they saw in you that they felt that you would be a great contributor?
Sounds good. So actually, when I was at smaller companies, I was on the software engineering side, so I wasn't doing much product management. I feel like though at a smaller company, you do get exposed to all parts of the business, because it's not like you are just writing code as a software engineer. You kind of have to wear a lot of different hats and do a lot of different stuff. So I feel like having that background kind of helped me make the transition into product management, just because especially at like very small companies, like. It was very common for us to have like existential crises where we would like not be sure if we're building the right thing, or have to go back to the drawing board and figure out, you know, talk to customers and figure out what the right thing to build actually was. And even though I was a software engineer, I was in all those discussions and conversations. So I thought that's one thing that was really helpful. In terms of how I made the switch into product, I actually uh, so I, I I joined Google through the Associate Product Manager program. So this was back in 2011. I joined the program. This is a program at the time Marissa Meyer was running it. It was sort of a small program, very narrowly focused, still for like grads who are relatively new out of college to make the switch into product management. But it's sort of like a rotational program where you get to spend a year on different products, try things out, and then decide whether or not you want to stick with it. So that was at least how I made the switch into product. But I feel like everyone you talk to has a different path for how they get into product. But definitely, if you're sort of at least for a new university grad, I think the APM program is like an amazing opportunity and a good way to get exposed to the world of product and see what it's like, especially because of the rotational nature. You can sort of try out different things and see how it works. Cool. First question was, do you need to be technical to be a product manager? Absolutely not. I think part of that, honestly, though, is a function of the company you're at. Like, I know Google is a little unusual in that they have a culture of like very technical PMs. But that's definitely not true at the vast majority of other companies. And in terms of actually your technical ability helping you, it's fairly limited. Like I'm not coding as part of my day job. My job is mostly still like emails and meetings and convincing people. So technical skill set sort of helps you just to have conversations with engineers and be able to understand their vocabulary. But that's not really something you need like a technical background to be able to do necessarily. So I don't think it's that important. It's definitely not a prerequisite, and I think with Google being an exception at most companies, I think the bulk of product managers are non-technical. And then the second question was kind of around how you go around ideation and just coming up with ideas, and I think that's actually a really good question. One thing I've kind of like, I don't know, it's funny because sometimes like. Actually, this is an interview question I'll ask, or I'll ask people like, you know, how would you decide what to do for this product? And like a bad answer I get a lot of times, people will be like, oh, we'll just like look at the data and like figure out what to do based on that. But like the data is not going to tell you how to build your product, and it's not going to like the data is not going to say do X, Y, and Z. It's kind of your job as a product manager to the way I would describe it is like you're always like coming up with hypotheses and like things that you want to test. And that's I feel like hypothesis generation is mostly like intuition. Like you think that something might be wrong, or you think that there's an opportunity to do this thing, and then you look at the data and use that to validate, is this a good idea that I thought of? Is this actually like going to help people in the way that I think it is? You don't use data to generate these hypotheses, but use them to like validate your hypotheses and make sure it's a good idea before you do a bunch of work and build the thing. But in terms of how you generate the hypothesis, I do think it's a lot of intuition. I definitely think it's like, it's not, you know, to your point of like, is it something you're just born with or something you learn? I think it's definitely something you learn. I think just like, you know, there's obviously you can see what different people have done, what's worked, what hasn't. It's a lot of just like, it's a lot of just asking questions too, like, you know, just asking the team, have we tried this before? You know, what about X, what about Y, and just like, just sort of being probing and trying to understand it as much as you can, and
great talk, by the way, and I have a question. When you said you use consensus, like the top-down approach, so my question is, I want to know, like, when you use the top-down approach and you have consensus from the higher-up, but your team doesn't get that motivated, and if you have any example in your life where you go about trying to convince the team, like how do you do it? Like what do you do to convince your team and get them motivated?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Sort of like if you have top-down consensus and the team is sort of burnt out and feels like they've just like been overridden, how do you motivate them? It's hard. I don't think there's like a really good answer for like a perfect solution to do that. You know, ultimately it just comes down to like figuring out what people are incentivized and figuring out how best to do that. Actually, it's interesting. I had to deal with that recently, and this was like a remote team that was based in another office in another country. And one thing I found that like, you know, at first they were sort of disgruntled about having to do this work. And one thing I found that helped is like, actually I had like me and my engineers, we flew over. And we sort of hung out with them in the office for like a few days, and like you know, spent a lot of time just meeting face to face with them, and like, and that relationship is so much better now, just because like before we were like these, just these people on email sending angry emails, and now like they kind of understand where we're coming from, and like we're all just reasonable people trying to get things done, and like just building that empathy through like meeting them face to face helped out a lot. So yeah, it's definitely hard. I don't say there's like an easy answer to it, but there's a few tools you can use. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. So you're kind of, just to make sure I understood it correctly, like your point is the way things are structured in your organization right now, there's these product requirements, there's another group of people who translate this to technical requirements, and then there's a separate set of people who implement those technical requirements, and those implementers are not exposed to the business requirements or the product requirements. So yeah, that seems, I've worked with my teams typically is like, I feel like it's definitely important for the engineers to be exposed to the product and business requirements. Sort of to your point earlier, like that's how the engineers kind of have empathy for the user and you know what or the business needs or what they're actually trying to build. Because like no one, I feel like you know if you're just like given a bunch of technical things to implement, you're not going to be very motivated. But if you're given a problem that you're trying to solve and like a need you're trying to fulfill, it's much more personally fulfilling as an engineer to be working on that. And then the other thing that, I don't know, the other way I've typically done things is typically like my engineers will look at my product requirements and the people doing the engineering work are also the ones making the technical decisions about how to go about implementing the product in the right way. And very much to the point where I also have to make sure that I take a backseat on technical decisions because I don't want to be kind of micromanaging the team and deciding, telling them what backends to use and that sort of stuff. Like ultimately, like, It's the people who are doing the work who should be making those decisions because they're the ones who are going to have to live with that decision and kind of deal with that on a regular basis. So it seems like, yeah, at least the way I've done things normally is like pretty radical transparency. Everyone can see the business requirements, feel motivated by it, and come up with the best solution for it. Yeah, so the question was about sort of how do you, if you're working with a team, how do you make sure your work gets prioritized and gets done? Obviously, there's a few situations I've been in. So the ideal situation is the one in which like there's a dedicated PM to engineering mapping. So obviously, if like all the work that they're doing is like scoped out by you, you have pretty good say about over prioritization. I think the challenge is when you're trying to get your work prioritized by another team. I feel like the really blunt brute force solution to this is you just like have update meetings and that sort of stuff. It's definitely a challenge. Like I think like you know even weekly updates can kind of seem imposing. Although it's definitely like you know I've had to do daily stand-ups, I've had to do weekly updates to make sure that things are happening on other teams. It's interesting. I think definitely like one thing that helps is sort of positive motivation. So definitely like when I have other teams that do work for me, I make sure that they're recognized a lot for it. So if they did something that like resulted in a certain percentage improvement in some key metric, I'll send that out to like their boss and their management and their leadership and our leadership. So kind of everyone sees like, basically, like at least if you can give people credit for the work that they did, you can sort of like motivate them to want to do more and to feel good about helping you out because you're actually giving them credit. So I think that's another thing that definitely helps just to set up the incentives.
I think,
So thank you so much for the talk. And what if you're in a situation that you're pushed to meet deadline and you have to ship the product where your H team is not happy and they are crunched, like basically the time is crunched and they have to ship the whole product, and how do you deal with this?
Cool. You deal with aggressive deadlines. So I think there's a few, like obviously as your job as a PM is to kind of figure out what is like the minimum viable thing that we need to ship. So oftentimes that means like making really hard cuts. One thing, and the reason I think that's really important is I think if you don't step in as a PM and make super hard cuts when there's a tough deadline, everything will get done really poorly. Which is like a terrible situation to be in, and you'd much rather like ship a product with less functionality that works really well, and everything is tested, and you're not cutting corners. So it's kind of just comes down to like figuring out what you can cut, what you can take out of it, and also like you know if there's if things aren't also you know I feel like part of it is also like debugging. Why is it that we're so behind schedule? Are there certain dependencies that like need to be unlocked? Are there other teams where we need to escalate and get support from their leadership to make things happen? I think definitely like a lot of times projects get into this like cadence of like being delayed regularly, and if you're like constantly missing your deadlines, I think it's definitely a wake up call to like figure out okay what's going wrong. Obviously like you know there's something wrong in terms of how we're is this much harder than we thought it was going to be? Are there things outside our control that we can fix? So I think definitely debugging like why it is things are moving slowly is also really important.
So you mentioned that you have an engineering background and now you are a PM. So let's assume that your engineer set up a team, they have a different opinion about a certain plan and you do not really agree with that. Then in such a case, without micromanaging, how do you go about that situation?
Yeah, so I think it's a good question. Definitely there's oftentimes like I have different technical opinions about something on the team. Sometimes it's a lot of times for me, it's just trying to understand the team stance a little better and why it is they went with a certain technical approach as to another. Sometimes like when I talk to them and try to understand them, and you know, we assuming everyone is a reasonable person, like they'll have good reasons for what they did, and I'll back down on my stance. Another times, you know, if it's a more philosophical disagreement or just around like this versus that, I generally am happy to be overridden on those things. Like I've definitely had teams do things I didn't agree with. Like I was like, oh, why do we have an extra backend here when we could just like call this API directly? Those are like examples of things I will just back down on because it's like, okay, ultimately like the engineering team is the one living with the decision, not me. And like if even if they make a bad decision, if it's theirs, at least there's some level of attachment to it, and they're incentivized to make it be the right decision. So I found like just generally backing down on not trying to override them has been the right approach.
Thank you. Sometimes you have new ideas, they may not have much of a business sense in the short term. Maybe if you take into context or feedback that it brings on other products or other ideas, maybe it has a complementary effect. But how do you go about drawing the line when you want to stop and when you want to say, no, this is wrong, product doesn't make sense?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there's actually the bulk of what I work on doesn't immediately impact revenue or bottom line. So I think what it comes down to in that case is just being really methodical about how you define success. Like it could be, you know, as an example, you're not trying to, like, let's say you work on Google search. Maybe you don't want to launch, maybe you just want, like you can sort of come up with like, maybe your goal is like a retention goal or it's a daily active user goal or it's like getting users to search more commercial intent queries or certain types of queries and that won't immediately lead to direct revenue but sort of will drive that in the long term. So I think even if you're not working on revenue facing stuff, you can still be regimented around like coming up with how you measure that and at least hold yourself accountable to that so you make sure that whatever metric that is, even if it's not a dollar metric, is something that's trending positive.